Welcome to the Old Pueblo New Economy podcast, which covers a wide range of stories and innovators that shape our regional economies. From the rising stars with Nick Morin, to the creative community with Julie Bonner, to Mentor Me Live and regional investor deep dives with Aaron Eden. We are one platform showcasing the diverse voices in our local community. We are the Old Pueblo New Economy. Welcome back to Investor's Corner. This is your host, Aaron Eden, and this week we're going to talk with Brian Ellerman, angel investor and the founding director for Arizona Forge. As both a technology scout and an angel investor, Brian brings a very impartial and diplomatic view to help entrepreneurs navigate these early stage investments. So with that, welcome to the show, Brian.
Let's dive right in. So why don't you share with the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background? How'd you get into this crazy investing world?
It's been a long, strange trip, and certainly anything but a straight line. I actually come from a science background. I studied the genes of cancer originally, then went on to clinical pathology, went to work actually at St. Mary's Hospital back in the 90s, mid-90s. And while I was there, I just fell in love with this interface between healthcare and technology, particularly data and information, and started a couple technology companies, mainly focused around how to improve things like physician access to patient information, scheduling, all of the kinds of things that maybe we take for granted today, maybe quite realistically, we still haven't quite figured out. That took me actually to Eller and the MIS program. I did a master's there, which then opened a completely new door in the middle of the dot-com era, and worked locally for Mad Media for a year, then went to work at Sunquest, which became Mises. That didn't work because of the acquisition, so I suddenly found myself working on a golf game instead of for a company, and started to explore sort of what were my roots, what did I really enjoy. And it was around that time that Aventis called and was looking for someone with a background just like mine, kind of a scientific computing background. I was there for 15 years, saw multiple mergers and acquisitions, ultimately led technology scouting globally for the company, which then took me into a global program management role where I was working on how to change the conduct of clinical trials for a 130,000 employee company with a $4 billion clinical trial operations budget. So it was moving a very large ship, and I was burning myself out very quickly those last 2 years. So I left there, end of 2017, was actually convinced to create something new at the University of Arizona, and Forge, which is finding opportunities and resources to grow entrepreneurs, was born in July of last year under Research Innovation Impact and Dr. Betsy Cantwell. Forge is this really unusual thing where it sits. The university is kind of a mix of environments. So it's not enough to just focus in any one area. So we have one piece that is entirely focused on students, and we call that Forge.UA. And its purpose is developing an entrepreneurial mindset in every student that comes to the university, regardless of what they end up majoring in. Second group, we have this beautiful building downtown. I'm sure many of your listeners, if they're familiar with downtown Tucson, have been by the Roy Place building. They may not know that's its name, but it's this building at almost the 00 mark. And so Forge at Roy Place is really about the community and how do we engage. We've invited Startup Tucson to base their operations from there. And we run an advanced entrepreneur program 3 times a year from that location. And then the newest piece of Forge is called Forge Ahead, and that's our accelerator. So, you know, we have wonderful partners like UACI to do a lot of the incubation, but there are these special cases where a startup's ready for that scale up and launch, and Forge Ahead serves that purpose. And we have a number of companies that are resident startups in Forge Ahead who we're working with to help get them up and off the ground. And I think you've even had a few on your own show. It's been a long, strange trip, like I said.
Absolutely. I've got a quick question about the accelerator. I guess it's based in a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, so I'm curious about it. A lot of folks in around Tucson and in the area tend to misuse the term incubator versus accelerator. And so are you using the proper terminology for accelerator? You guys are actually making investments in these startups?
So it's a fantastic question, Aaron, and I really appreciate it. The way that we put this is, number one, the Advanced Entrepreneur Program that we run is a seed accelerator. So there is no equity stake, but it's also run over a very limited period of time with a cohort. When I talk about Forge Ahead as an accelerator, you're absolutely right to call out the question about the investment. And, you know, one of my challenges is that we are going with, as a University of Arizona entity, and as a state institution, taking equity is not something that we can do. It's not part of the university's charter. Full disclosure, we are working through the mechanism to be able to do those kinds of things where we can both put capital into a startup and in turn take a piece of equity. But I use the term accelerator today because of the fact that we have resident startups who are getting highly customized support in terms of mentoring, advice, access to capital, access to experts, and so on, that it doesn't really fit the incubator model. And, you know, I'll defer to NBIA on those definitions beyond that.
Not intended to get into a terminology or anything like that, but it's something that I keep seeing. So I'm like, are we in there? So it's all good. Thank you for clarifying. That's wonderful. Can you dive a little bit into your investing experience? How deep does that go? How long have you been investing? What does that space look like for you?
So my origins actually go back to around 1999 and 2000. You know, I'd had some success with the startups that I'd gotten off the ground. And around 2000, late 2000, I had kind of finished all that and thought, man, that was really hard getting those companies off the ground. You know, I did it all myself. I didn't go to any investors. In fact, I didn't even know what an angel investor was. And someone had pointed me to the Desert Angels, who just started, and said, hey, you should go talk with those guys. And I thought, hey, that sounds like fun. Maybe I'll find people who put money in and would be interested, or I could do that with them. And I have to be honest, at that point in time, the Desert Angels looked more like a country club than it did an actual group of investors. And you have to remember, I was still in my 20s. So guy in 20s who's just launched three companies and is now looking to try to make things easier for the next guy in his 20s or woman in her 20s, doesn't want to see a bunch of old dudes, you know, talking about their golf game or playing tennis or whatever else. And so I walked away, kind of took the crazy route that I mentioned earlier. And it was actually in taking on my tech scouting role where I got to travel around the world and visit incubators and accelerators and meet with venture capital and startups. And it really planted the seed in my own mind of, I need to get involved in this. There are some fantastic opportunities that I would love to invest in. So I had gone through AngelList, for example, and joined a number of syndicates there and started investing largely on things that I understood fairly well, digital health, anything on the space or space technology side. I think, you know, what's fair to say is the places where I veered too far away from my own strengths are probably the places where I often got burned. There was a wonderful, or I thought it was a wonderful startup that was going to essentially Uberize art and make it so that you could bid on and purchase art and see it on your wall. And then, you know, okay, I'm done with this, move on. Thought they were brilliant. They don't exist anymore. Some things in the social media space that, well, I've used social media. I certainly don't consider myself an expert. And actually, I have a really good story to tell you about one of the social media companies, but they're not around anymore either. You know, meanwhile, I can point to a number of things in the digital health and space and others that have had successful exits and have provided a return. And I should also add that I have been a member of the Desert Angels for the past 3 years. So I was strongly encouraged to come back and visit. And I have to say that I'm really impressed with the leadership and direction of the group. And I love working with Joanne Master.
She's a rock star for sure. So let's keep that thread going around where you were headed with some of the investments. You know, really what I hear the most from listeners is they really value being able to learn from investors' perspectives and hopefully increase their chances of success in their own ventures via others. So maybe can you grab an example story or two and let's dive deeper on some of those?
Sure. Yeah. You know, and I want to do so also kind of reinforcing the point that one of the things that drew me to go and launch Forge is this idea that we're helping entrepreneurs. You know, we're not motivated by the, I only look for unicorns. We're motivated by the individuals and helping them build the best company that they can, whatever that company looks like. So I just, you know, I think it's really important for people to understand that the term entrepreneur is not limited to a particular demographic. It's not limited to certain capital path or what have you. So I mentioned this social media company, and they were one of my earliest investments. The CEO, founder CEO, had asked me after I invested if I'd join his board. And we must have spent weeks trying to finalize an agreement document. And mind you, I wasn't trying to be problematic in the creation of the document. I just wanted it to sort of fairly call out, what are your expectations of me and the time that you need me to provide? And in return, is there a set of options or what's going to be on that side? And to have taken weeks was a little bit troubling for me. It gave me a couple lessons or taught me some things that I would want to share with other aspiring and existing entrepreneurs. The first is find and hire people who have the core competencies you do not. If you don't have a legal background, find someone. You don't have to have them full time, but at least have them available and accessible to you so that when it comes time to try to draw up an agreement with a prospective board member, you've got it. They just pull it off the shelf, they tailor it to you, and they return it to you almost the same day. I'd add finance to that. I know a lot of folks who bring on people who have extensive experience in finance rather than doing it themselves. Don't go it alone. All you're doing, I think, as a founder, CEO, going it alone is refusing to acknowledge your own weaknesses or shortcomings at exactly the moment in time you need to be embracing those things and finding the skill to support you through, hopefully, your growth and success. The second takeaway from it for me was have things like this buttoned down before you go and ask. Like, don't say to somebody, hi, would you like to be an advisor? And then when they say yes, now I'm going to start to work on what that looks like and all of the details. Know exactly upfront and ahead of time what you have in mind for that person. And frankly, you ask them, you should be handing them that agreement or at least a draft of it. Good advisors are in high demand. And I mean that on both sides of that, right? If they are a good advisor, they should be in demand. If they're not in demand, I wonder whether they're a good advisor or at least the right person for your needs. And so respect that time that you're asking of them and in turn show them that you're worth investing the time in. Don't have them sort of questioning their priorities, like, ooh, did I maybe make a bad choice in agreeing? But also in this situation, I found myself thinking, wow, if he has this much time to be trying to work out an agreement with me, I'm wondering how much time he's actually spending building the business and working on it. Did I make a good investment? So that would be, I think, you know, something that I would take away from that particular investment and that experience with this social media company.
Those are some important lessons for sure. on the not going at it alone and really understanding your core competencies and surrounding yourself with others that can fill those gaps. How did that show up? This was a solo founder, or I guess, how did that show up?
Yeah, I actually learned of them through a conference that I'd attended, and the person that he brought in as a chief, I think, marketing and other role had pointed me to the company. So it wasn't solo, but he definitely didn't have anyone on staff to address any of the things like legal agreements and the financial side.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's such a delicate balance to strike between sort of the opposite end of that spectrum. You see founders on day one going out and building a website and putting together business cards and doing t-shirts and this kind of stuff when, you know, there's no customer base and it's way premature to be doing those things. But I love the way you painted that, which is like, hey, if you're going to go out and ask an advisor to help you with your company, at least have a little bit of that fleshed out. It doesn't have to be a perfectly functional agreement, but at least say, here's a couple of the key things that we believe are important to you. We can work some of the other stuff out quickly, but don't go with a blank piece of paper.
Yeah, exactly. I would be much more comfortable with someone that has a solid agreement draft in hand than someone who has a beautiful logo on a coffee mug.
Yeah, absolutely. So you said they're not around anymore.
Nope.
So unfortunately, not a great financial outcome, but it sounds like some solid lessons from it, which is valuable. Any other stories you've got in your back pocket you might want to share with us?
Yeah, one of the other themes that I see come up quite often, and which I can think of multiple examples, is around valuation. So I recall a medical device company that I had met with, where the founder had about 3x valuation compared to what the typical value would be, and presenting to a group of investors who are all almost overwhelmingly saying, how do you justify that valuation? I don't get it. It doesn't make sense. And to have the founder just kind of keep saying, yeah, I picked this number, or I arrived at this, I know what I'm doing. Okay. And what was interesting for me was to see this person going around the, what I call the funding circuit, whether it's the angel groups or some of the local or regional VC. It's, you know, because we all talk to each other, we know when they're presenting to someone. And this person went 3 times around the funding circuit before, and each time the valuation was a little lower and a little, you know, and so watching that valuation start to approach something that was closer to reality and what's expected. So, you know, for me, some of the key takeaways are listening to experts who do this a lot. Most of us in the angel community probably see 100 slide decks a month. And the screening panel, for example, for the Desert Angels is anywhere between 8 and 12 each month. So, you know, there's this attrition, but we're all kind of living out there seeing these things. And so you know what's normal, you know what's expected and reasonable and what might not be. I'll also say this, valuation is an art, but I know an ugly painting when I see one. If you're a founder, CEO, and you're trying to sound out your valuation, ask a couple people like me and others, what do you think? And then hopefully, and I think this is maybe the last piece, is listen, take that into consideration. It doesn't make us right. It doesn't make you wrong. But the thing is, you need to be able to explain your valuation no matter what your path is. And we published last month a white paper on early stage funding. And I wrote a whole section just on valuation because I think it's so important for founders to understand that even if you're not out raising capital, you're still valuing your company in some way. And if you go to do, let's say you do a micro loan, you now have, you know, that amount plus whatever sweat equity you've put into it is a value for your company. Or if you've gone the grant route, you can take some valuation of what you're worth using some of the grant dollars. Now, I want to be really clear when I say that. I'm not suggesting that you landed that $250,000 grant, therefore you should just take that number, multiply it, and say, there you go, we're worth $750,000. That's not how that works, but those are funds that are going to build something real, and something real is a good part of what goes into valuation. Even if you're going to go out and pitch this to friends and family, well, they're going to give you money. What is that worth? And what it's worth has a lot to do with the valuation. So anyway, I think, you know, coming through that particular example and then thinking about our white paper and all of the different funding sources that are out there and available, founders really got to start by understanding and being able to speak intelligently to their own valuation.
So I think you hit the nail on the head. It's art, not science. But at least that entrepreneur, you know, they had 3x valuation, went 3 times around the circuit, kind of kept coming down, right? Like, luckily they weren't at 4x. They might not have made it around the circuit the fourth time.
That's very true.
So on that valuation front, one of the other, I'm spacing who it was at the moment, but one of the other investors I was interviewing recently had some lessons learned in that space as well. And one of the things that he called out is that it's an odd situation to be in as an investor, because in that early stage during those valuation conversations, it's almost like you're on opposing sides of the table between the investor and the entrepreneur. But really where you want to be on the long term is on the same side of the table, working together around those things. And so it's a really difficult, seems to me it would be a really difficult situation to be in and hard waters to navigate. What's your take on that? What do you see in that space?
No, I think it's well put. Think of yourself as a dance partner. If you're dancing with someone else, you can't also solo. You know, you need to be in sync. And the other aspect to that I think, you know, your comment is touching on is the person that is physically across the table ultimately has to feel like they're getting a reasonable part of the company, that it's fairly priced in what they're putting their money, and in turn, that there's room left for growth. So there, what I'm getting at is a smart investor does not try to get so greedy in the first bite of the apple that there's no apple left and that there's no future. If I invest in something and I take half the company, what's left for the founder to do with that and to grow? So there should be this balance between a reasonable stake that still leaves equity in the company, and at the same time isn't so small that whoop-de-doo, you became that unicorn, let's say, but I own, you know, an infinitesimal percentage of it. So that's why I think the best investors have a very honest dialogue with founders about what a reasonable portion should be. And conversely, good founders also sound that out and seek advice on what is a fair both valuation overall, and then if I'm going to give away a portion, what's a reasonably sized portion that will be interesting to people but still leave me room to grow?
The art and the balance.
Community Investment Corps, located in Tucson and serving Southern Arizona, empowers small business owners with knowledge and access to capital. CIC believes in economic inclusion and supports entrepreneurs and small business owners at all stages with the practical resources and education they need to thrive and turn dreams to reality. CIC is a proud founding sponsor of this podcast.
You mentioned the white paper that was released. When was that? It's been a couple months, right? 3 months, something like that? 2 months?
I think we officially put it out at the beginning of October. It was treated as a Q4 release.
Nice.
Yeah, and I really want to acknowledge co-authors in Danny Nee and Carrie Davis at CIC, Johnny Price at WeFunder, and Liz Pocock at Startup Tucson. You know, it was great working with all of them, and I think what I particularly enjoyed about the project was how we could span a range from these things cost you absolutely nothing. I won't say it's free money, but it's free resources. It's things that just being in our ecosystem gets you access to. And Liz wrote that. And I called this section before funding, the networks and the resources and the podcast. And then, we looked at micro lending, which typically is constrained at 50,000 or less. And then talked a bit about crowdfunding, which of course is itself this burgeoning area with, especially with the SEC rule changes that are now allowing up to $5 million in equity crowdfunding. So while the averages are still sub 100,000, it does represent, I think, a really interesting path. And historically, investors, angel investors and VC shied away from companies that had done crowdfunding because it created very complicated cap tables. So the capitalization of a company, all of those percentages have to be listed out, and there are limitations on how many people you can have, both from a corporate registration point of view, but also, let's face it, I want math that's really easy, and I want to know that in the next round, the numbers are going to continue to sort of work in a nice linear path. What I don't want is that suddenly I discovered that there's this whole group of people that got grandfathered into a different status than I did as an investor, and they still own 10%, and now suddenly I've been reduced by half and so on. That's been, I think, highly simplified in this equity crowdfunding approach that WeFunder is using, where all those people get entered on a single line in the cap table. And that, I think, gives a lot of angel investors some peace of mind that we're not going to be evaluating a company and seeing just this mess of a cap table. And then, as mentioned, I covered an equity investing portion to talk about the different ways in which equity can be offered or be done. And that can range, from very typical types of approaches, price round, so to speak, all the way to SAFE, which themselves have been subject to some controversy, mainly because they sometimes are written in a way that there's no cap, there's no upper bound of what the company will be valued at. In that, again, as an investor, when I'm faced with 100 choices, don't make it complicated for me in this at this stage. If I want to invest in someone, I want to know what my investment's worth and what's going to happen, in successive rounds. And if I have to start getting into guessing or funny math, all things being equal, I'll go somewhere else. Then the last thing I'll say on the white paper and some of the discussion is that we were able to pull in all of these great perspectives from all over. So we have some founders with their hard-won wisdom. We've got folks who've authored fantastic books around entrepreneurial ecosystems and doing the startup community way, for example, that Brad Feldman Hathaway wrote. Nicolas Collin, who's based in Paris, who wrote a book called Hedge. We had John Deary, who's the president or founder and CEO of the Center for American Entrepreneurship. We were able to kind of pull in all these great people and get their perspectives and interlay that throughout the document with this really solid set of ideas and guidance on where people can go to get more.
It goes pretty in depth. It's like 25 or 30 pages, something like that. Really strong. I don't know that we actually mentioned the title of it, and I'll make sure that I link to it in the show notes as well. But if you're wondering, it's Early Stage Funding, Options, Sources, and Consequences. And then the subtitle is A Community-Based White Paper for Aspiring and First-Time Founders. I'm curious, how did this project come about? What was the team seeing in our ecosystem that told you that this was important?
Yeah, what's truly funny is part of the impetus for writing this was to dispel some myths. I had for the umpteenth time heard someone say, if they did a SAFE previously, I'm not interested in investing them. I won't. It's a non-starter. And I kept saying, but, you know, explain to me why. What is it about a safe that you don't like? And sometimes they could put it into words, or sometimes they had sort of generalizations. But a lot of the time it was just, it had like become this institutional knowledge or idea that couldn't be shaken. And I thought, all right, I'm going to write a section that talks all about debunking the myths of things like safes. And right around that time, we had Stackhouse, who was going through crowdfunding. And I had received a note from someone that when the news of the crowdfunding came out, they said, oh, well, guess we'll never invest in them. And I'm thinking, wait, now crowdfunding is also taboo. So, okay, I need to do a bit on crowdfunding. And then, of course, with Forge and our role in trying to develop entrepreneurial thinking and resources throughout the community, I really wanted to get Startup Tucson engaged in this and included. And there's a whole set of really great resources out there. So at this point, I more or less had created the co-author list because I needed to get someone who could talk about crowdfunding and someone who could talk about the equity investing and Startup Tucson and, you know, Community Investment Corporation, of course, with all of the micro lending that just made a lot of sense. So it sort of authored itself in that regard, based on trying to look at how do we shed some light on some of the prevailing misconceptions and at the same time make this really usable. I mean, I don't want to write a white paper just on how wrong someone is about an idea. I want to create a resource that we can continually update and expand. And that's actually, I should mention, why we close the document with the note from Nicolas Carlin, is that we're in a global world and investors can be anywhere and startups can be anywhere. And so I'm hoping that in a future version of this, we expand the view outside the United States and look, for example, at Europe and what's going on there. Because there are some really interesting distinctions, particularly culturally, and particularly around the notion of failure and bankruptcy that lead to kind of a stigma as a startup founder in Europe that you better not fail, because if you do, you're done. Which is why we see a large expat community in Silicon Valley and other hubs of startups is they decided, well, I'm not going to take a risk, of getting a black mark in Europe. I'll just go to the US where people will embrace me if I fail. You know, and so I want to look at how do we encourage that mindset elsewhere? And also, what are some things we can learn from abroad or expand the reach of those investment dollars to our own back door?
Have you heard any feedback from entrepreneurs or investors since you released it? What are you hearing?
Yeah, we had over 200 downloads of the document within the first, I don't know, week and a half. And we've had really good response from people, particularly some of the authors who have asked if they can kind of build it into some of the things that they're doing and their next round. We're reaching out to both Kauffman Foundation and a few others around where and how they might be able to incorporate this or make it a resource that's available to their community. Because again, we publish this completely free. We make no money from it. Its whole purpose is to be a free and widely available resource to entrepreneurs everywhere.
Super valuable. So definitely for entrepreneurs that are listening, go spend a little bit of time and review it. It's pretty dense, so you probably have to read it more than once, but still doesn't diminish the value of it. So super important. I wish I had had something like that years ago. Would have made my life a little bit better on a few startups.
Well, again, you know, going back to my own origin story, I found myself back in 99 wondering, where are all of the resources to make this easier? Why was this so hard? It shouldn't have been. And so a guiding principle in everything that we do and what Forge is about is making it easier for that next group of entrepreneurs to succeed and to know how to find the resources, or at least to know who to ask to get that help. Which is also why when we constructed the document, we tried to make it almost as if each section could stand on its own as its own reference and resource. Because maybe today you're not at a stage where equity investing is even relevant. You just need some of the free resources, or maybe you're ready for that microloan or whatever. You know, rather than write a novel and you have to pull the threads out of it, we wanted to make it something where each could serve as a reference by itself.
Well, and to build on that, and going back to the comment you made earlier about not just trying to serve unicorns and those kinds of things, the resources that are in there are just as applicable to somebody who intends to have a lifestyle business and keep it that way compared to somebody that wants to go, you know, found the next Ventana or whatever, right? So
exactly.
I guess Roche now, but anyway. Cool. So I noticed on your LinkedIn that you had a comment on there about don't contact me for investments right now, but I would like, if you're open to it, I'd love to ask you, you know, if folks do want to get a hold of you, how might they do that? And what are the situations that you would like for them to get a hold of you or not?
I appreciate that question, Aaron. Yeah, I get a lot of contacts every day by email and other around, hey, check out this awesome startup I've got. You know, we're going to be valued at 100 million by the end of next year. We just need to sell our first product and then we'll be all set. And so I got a lot of people trying to connect to me on LinkedIn solely because they wanted to pitch me. To me, that's wrong on every level. LinkedIn is about creating a network of valuable people that I can, when someone comes to me and says, I'm looking for an expert in X, I can pull up, you know, my network and point them to someone who's actually going to respond, who will answer the email or the question. If my LinkedIn is filled with a bunch of people who only wanted to connect to me because they were hoping I'd invest, well, then, you know, that weakens the network. So if people want to reach out, I mean, for sure, we have forge.arizona.edu is our website. We have a newsletter that we send out just about weekly. And we try to do features on founders that are in our programs. We try to do highlights of companies. And I write a monthly column, which this month will be guest written by a student who's been interning with me as our entrepreneurial fellow. So you'll get a perspective from a student who's been diving deep into the Forge world. But absolutely, our contact info is all there on our website, and I do welcome that. But yes, you're right. I do encourage people that if you're looking for an investment, go through other channels, seek it, you know, through whether it's groups like the Desert Angels or UAVC or what have you. Those are the sort of more formalized investing channels. And read our white paper, because it might have some guidance in there to help you find the right next step. You might not be ready for that venture capital just yet, despite the many emails that I get.
Well said, well said. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for spending a little bit of your time with us, Brian. And thank you for everything that you're doing to help move our ecosystem forward. It takes a village, as they say. So thank you for being a part of it.
And as a native Arizonan who grew up outside New York and got back here in 94, you know, I have a million reasons to want to see Tucson succeed in Southern Arizona. And I just love the old Pueblo new economy.
Thanks again for listening. I'd like to quickly summarize valuation lessons from this episode with Brian. The first one is to make sure that you're taking perspectives from the experts into account. Angel investors are seeing hundreds of presentations a month, and so they're seeing patterns. They know what's normal, what's reasonable, those kinds of things. Make sure you're taking that into account as you try to figure out your valuation. Also, be ready to defend and explain and clearly articulate why you got to the valuation that you have. There's lots of resources to help you with that, but really important to be able to back that up. And then finally, making sure that your valuation includes some room for growth. Make sure that it ensures that you have an ownership amount that motivates you going forward and still leaves a reasonable amount for investors as well to keep them excited. And we will wrap it up there. If you got something valuable from this episode or one of the other episodes, please give us a review on your favorite podcasting platform, and we'll see you next week.
We appreciate you listening to the Old Pueblo New Economy. If you enjoyed this episode, please check out all of our episodes and series on www.oldpuebloneweconomy.com or OPNE.biz for short. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our newsletter to receive upcoming episodes as they air. If you have any suggestions for who we should interview next, make sure to send us an email. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for next week's episode.